It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. This is episode 93, I Know Where I'm Going. I Know Where I'm Going, made by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, English filmmakers who made a number of other movies who perhaps are more well-known to American audiences. I don't know. But I Know Where I'm Going is a 1945 film from them, set during World War II, but not about World War II, which I'm sure we'll talk about. I have a wonderful panel of guests to talk about it with me, starting out with Nathan Alderman. Hi, welcome back.
Hi. So this was the second Michael Powell film I've seen. The first was Peeping Tom. Slight difference between the two films.
Good to know. Also here, Randy Dutinga. Hi.
Well, this whole movie just made me think about one of my favorite panelists on this podcast, Mickey Maynard, because that several episodes ago, Mickey talked about one thing that it's really important for a man to have in her eyes, and that's, in one word, is acreage.
Well, he doesn't only have acreage, he's got a castle.
And a kilt.
That gives him bonus points for me.
I mean, he could have a castle in the kilt, but anyway, moving on.
But, or a kilt in the castle.
In case you couldn't tell, Mickey Maynard is also here. Hello.
Hi, I'm just looking for a place in my lavish railroad compartment to hang up my wedding dress.
Well, friends, I'm really glad we talked about this movie. It's one of the rare movies on Lions, Towers, and Shields, which I didn't have much of a background with, and I'll tell that story shortly. But let me begin with my usual question. How familiar are you with this movie? Have you seen it before? Do you know it at all? Nathan Alderman, let's start with you.
So I feel like I've kind of absorbed Powell, and is it Pressburger or Pressburger? I'm going to say
Pressburger
because it sounds cool.
It sounds fancy.
Yeah, so fancy. I feel like I've absorbed them by osmosis from reading Criterion's website, but I'd never actually seen any of their films. So I'd heard about this one, and I'd heard, you know, it was charming and nice, and I'd never seen it before. And it was a really nice introduction to Powell and Pressburger for me. Certainly a really beautiful film, but I felt like it was kind of lacking something. Not acreage, though. Definitely had acreage.
Plenty of acreage and oceanfront views, that sort of thing. Randy, how about you? What's your background with this movie?
Okay, well, now whenever I see the name Emmerich Pressburger, I'm going to think of Pressburger, and then I'll think of a Royale with cheese. But anyway, like Nathan, I'm familiar with Peeping Tom, but not so much the other movies by these filmmakers. But I thought it was really, this is a very charming movie. And Wendy Hiller is, she's very Katharine Hepburn-esque, and she's a joy to watch. I didn't really get much of a vibe from Roger Livesey, who played, you know, Laird Macduff or whatever his name is.
Killoran.
Torquil McNeil, Laird Killoran.
Torquil. That's a mouthful.
But and I do have some questions about the whole wisdom of the boat trip at the end, and how nobody stopped that from happening. I'm like, don't do it. Just disable the boat. You're going to kill it.
Ah. We needed an adventure sequence and a chance to talk about Corey Vrecken at length, which I will later on. Last but not least, Mickey Maynard, you brought this movie to our attention a while back. You let us know about it in a draft. You picked it. I can't remember under what category, but you suggested we see it, and I'm really glad you did. So what's your background with this movie? How long have you known
it? So I discovered it on TCM, and Robert Osborne, the great late Robert Osborne, introduced the movie. And I'm a fan of the Red Shoes. You know, like a lot of little girls, I wanted to be a ballerina, and so I knew Michael Powell from The Red Shoes, and Robert Osborne said, you know, The Red Shoes, but you should also know this other movie by Michael Powell. And I have Scottish roots, so The Laird of Killoran is, you know, something that caught my ear when I saw it. And, you know, it to me, it's it's a, like you were saying, it's a World War II movie, but it isn't, the war is not that essential to the movie. But the other thing that I really like about it is Wendy Hiller playing a very spunky, determined heroine along the lines of a Katharine Hepburn. And you did not see that so much in British film. You could see it in some American film, but I just love this character. I love that, you know, she knew what she wanted. And the person that she reminds me of is Jenny, in the classic song, you know, the saga of Jenny. Jenny made her mind up when she was three. You know, she would light the candles on the Christmas tree. And that's always what comes to mind when I see this character and how single-minded she was about wanting to advance in the world.
Are we talking about Jenny from the Block here? Because that is not, I am not familiar with that portion of the Jennifer Lopez.
No, game. Not the Jenny from the
Block. And not Block. Pirate Jenny. Different. Oh, so many Jennies. A Portrait of Jenny. Anyway, yeah, I had not seen this before somehow, and I'm not sure how. And so I was actually, when this movie came up, and I looked it up, and I read a bunch about it, and I had seen some Pal Pressburger things before, but not this one. I was really intrigued, and I felt like this is one movie that I was willing to take a flyer on, and happily so, because it is very charming. I also looked forward to seeing Wendy Hiller because she made some American movies. She even won a Best Supporting Actress Oscar several years later, but she didn't make a ton of American movies. I think she's better known in England, and she did play Eliza Doolittle in Pygmalion mm-hmm. before this, which is a movie I had seen. It was one of the first old movies I ever saw, because I remember when I was in high school, our PBS station would play a bunch of old movies as part of pledge drives. And most of them were musicals like Kiss Me, Kate and Silk Stockings. And I loved all that kind of stuff. But once they played Pygmalion, which is a very English version of the My Fair Lady, or of that story that was made in 1938. It was closer to the George Bernard Shaw original, and Wendy Hiller was in it. And I remember just being struck by her and thinking, you know, I'd like to see more of this person. But she's just not somebody that shows up on an American film fan's radar so much. And the Katharine Hepburn connection eluded me until you guys were just talking about it. I was like, yeah, I can kind of see that. Because I think she's really, her character is really interestingly written. She does have spunk. She does know where she's going, although, you know, it ends up not being where she wants to go at the end. But she has much more single-mindedness than many female characters of this era or of any era, frankly.
Mm-hmm. One of the things about Wendy Hiller, she's a great favorite in my family. My mother was a huge fan of Wendy Hiller. And in one of her trips to London, she saw Wendy Hiller play Queen Mary in Crown Matrimonial, which was the story of Queen Mary and Edward VIII and the Duchess of Windsor, who, you know, the Wallace Simpson who became the Duchess of Windsor. And it was told from the perspective of the queen of this whole abdication and things like that. My mother came back from London just raving about having seen Wendy Hiller on stage. And this was the 70s, so it would have been an older Wendy Hiller. So for me, you know, having heard about her from my mom, it was interesting to see Wendy Hiller as a young woman rather than the stately dame of the British theater.
Yeah, she lived to 2003, mm-hmm. and she had quite a long career. And she's one of those people who has been given rank in England that is referred to routinely as, you know, Dame Wendy Hiller. She's got the OB the she's got the DSE, it says, actually. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because, like I say, I just think it's fascinating to find that she's so little known in the U.S. Neither is Roger Livesey or Livesey. I'm not certain how that's pronounced.
I don't know that he had that much of a career, really.
He did a few Pyle and Pressburger things, mm-hmm. but that's about all I could see. Yeah. So this is not a movie of really well-known actors, although there are a couple of interesting exceptions to that we'll get to because they're kind of small parts. But yeah, you have this woman who from literally the first shot of the movie, as a baby crawling on the floor, is, you know, embodying the title, which can either become very cloying right away or just, you know, is a through line of the film that kind of works. And after those first couple scenes, after the narration stops and we actually meet her as an adult woman, I'm fine with it. The fact that the initial scene is like her crawling on the floor as a baby, and then the credits come in, which is nice. The credits are interspersed through those scenes of her growing up, which is a nice way to break those boring little bits up. Mm-hmm. But I literally think the worst frame of the movie is the first one.
I thought those opening credits were so incredibly clever. What a playful and interesting visual way to get you into the story. And that persisted a lot through the opening sequence, really, until she arrives in Scotland. I loved the zoom in on the top hat that becomes the railroad smokestack. I loved the sequence in her railroad cabin, where the dream sequence, and how clever that is, the wonderful use of sound. And it kind of surprised me when all of that went away as soon as she got to Scotland. I would have loved to see more of that visual playfulness and creativity throughout the movie.
I agree with that. And I didn't really like the first shot of the movie of the character, but I love the way the credits are intermingled in the beginning. And there is this playfulness, even to the point of when she's having the dream sequence and she's literally saying, "I do" to the company, rather the chemical company, rather than the rich man.
And she's fine with it.
Right. Mm-hmm. She's totally fine with it. She knows where she's going, after all. It feels to me like the movie is divided into three parts. There's that whole part until she gets up to Scotland. She starts out, we're introduced to her as she grows, and then we meet her first when she's having dinner with her father and basically saying, "I'm going to go get married." And then she has that whole train journey to Scotland, which is teased out in, as you say, a super interesting way. I've never seen a travel itinerary used so much in a movie. And then the second part is basically most of her time in Scotland, and the last part is the sort of will they or won't they survive this boat trip and what's going to happen with her and Torquil.
Yeah, Torquil. That name, everything about the character is not doing him any favors, except maybe the kilt. The kilt's doing him some favors.
Yeah, he looks like someone named Torquil. I don't know. He just doesn't have much of a manly presence. I'm not quite sure what she sees in him.
Well, and I don't know what he sees in her, because she does come off as kind of superficial and single-minded in terms of chasing wealth. And he's the Laird of Killoran, but he isn't really wealthy. He's not rolling in dough, and the castle's an ancient ruin. And, you know, he might have stature among the people of Killoran, but he isn't, you know, this isn't like the lifestyles of the rich and famous, you know.
He's still living in a castle on a beautiful island, a castle that he allows rich people to pay to fix up for him, and then he'll go back and live in it after they're done. He's got acreage, like Randy said.
I don't see an awful lot of chemistry between them, honestly. I mean, they tell us they're going to fall in love, and there are a couple looks between them that are kind of nice, but you just have to sort of take it on faith that they're having chemistry and that what she's falling in love with as well as him is a very different kind of life than she originally wanted. But I'll move us back to the first part of the movie where she's traveling to Scotland. I was astonished. So first of all, she's with her father at the restaurant and basically says, "Have a drink, Dad. I have something to tell you." And she's going to get married to this rich guy, i.e. the chemical company. And he takes her to the train station, and there's no question of him getting on the train with her. I thought for a minute he would. It's like, okay, we're going to go to Scotland to the wedding. But he just says, bye. And she's going to go to this remote island in Scotland and get married. And her dad, is, and presumably whatever family she has, is not invited or doesn't have time or something. He's a bank manager. She's grown up middle class, so she's not impoverished by any means. But clearly her goal is to marry into wealth, and she's extremely single-minded. The clips you see of her, or the narration you see of her when she's a young person, is that she wants material things, and she also wants to make a success of herself, by which she will eventually make a successful marriage and be rich and be out of whatever impoverishedness she feels her current life has.
So I want to draw just maybe a dotted line connection to the Philadelphia Story. Because, you know, Tracy Lord's second marriage is supposed to be to George Kittredge, self-made millionaire, I'm assuming millionaire, and Sir Robert Bellinger, the wealthy, much older industrialist. I think he got his title because he was an industrialist and not a a landed gentry type of title or a hereditary title. It seemed
1,000,000%.
Yeah, yes. It seemed very much like he was he got, you know, in the king's honors or something like that, his title. So sort of like a Richard Branson type person. And the Laird of Caloran goes back to the ancient times. So maybe in her mind, that trumps new money, I suppose you could say.
I really had a problem. My one problem with the movie, and it's a big one, is the central relationship. We know where she's going, but we don't know why she's going. The film never really lets us into her head or anyone else's head, or heart for that matter, to really understand why she's so driven and single-minded. I mean, yes, it's refreshing that she is. She's spunky and feisty and independent, and that's lovely. And it's not Wendy Hiller or Roger Livesey's fault, because I really like the way that they play their attraction to each other. I really like the way Wendy Hiller in particular is like, no, I am not going to be attracted to this guy. I've got everything I want. I'm all set. I am not going to let myself fall for this guy. She plays that with a smoldering intensity that I really liked. I never really understood why they were falling for each other, why they were attracted to each other, what brought them together. It was mainly like, hi, I'm a man. Oh, really? I'm a woman. Let's spend a few days together. Well, I guess we're in love now.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of is that she was just so different. You know, the women that he was meeting were Scots women, you know, and we tend to be pretty stern. Not stern, I don't think that's the right word, but, you know, we're made of pretty hardy stuff. And she's not. She's a girl from the city. She takes her wedding dress on the train. She clearly is sort of an exotic creature to him. But, you know, the thing I do wonder about is does she really have the right background to be the lady of Caloran? I mean, that's going to be a very important position on this. It's the Isle of Mun, I think, where this was filmed. And you know, she'll have position there. It's not British. I shouldn't say British. It's not English position. It's Scottish position. And a lot of Scots noble people are not, they don't put on airs. You know, they're down to earth people. And I do wonder a little bit about her fitting in when she stays behind on the island.
She got a trio of bagpipers to follow her to an ancient ancestral keep. I think she's going to do just fine.
It'll be interesting because even when you see them go to the dinner at the, you know, the well-off family that's well-off enough to have gardeners that have their own Kayleys, you know, those people are very down to earth. All the people that she meets who are of, you know, means in that town and on that island are very sort of, they don't, There seem to be mixing of the classes, and there seem to be, you know, sort of rollicking conversations at dinner tables and smart aleck children and all sorts of things. You're meant to understand that even where money is in limited supply, but even where the money, some limited amount of money exists, these people are very different than what she kind of aspires to, which is not like she's not aspiring to English nobility. She's aspiring to industrialist nobility. Mm-hmm. And as you say, he probably got his title, you know, the old fashioned way he bought it. But it's not, she's not going to be spending time with somebody who's entertaining, you know, lords and ladies from way back, even if she ends up marrying the industrialist. She's just going to be really, really rich and presumably living somewhere other than that island, because they're going to get married on that island, but I don't know where they're meant to live.
Probably in London.
The industrialist never comes across really negatively, or even his friends. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is that scene over the radio where they're talking to him, and he's like the movie wants you to think he's a bit of a drip, but I don't feel like he ever comes across that poorly. Like he's not like a villain. And I was intrigued that they didn't portray him in a more negative way, so you can see her transformation where she's starting to question that relationship and starting to go for, you know, Laird Macduff, McDougal or whatever.
Yeah, he's not much of a presence, but neither is Torkoal. Torkoal's just sort of there, and he's vaguely charming and nice enough, but yeah, you're like, him? Really?
Yeah, he's kind of the only viable option there. And yeah, that's kind of why I have a little trouble believing the chemistry between them, because, yeah, there's something going on there. But he's being a nice host, right? He's taking her around all these places as she's trying her best to get to the island. And he's, you know, guiding her around and telling her about his home. But they're really not making much of a personal connection until you get to the Kaylee a little bit later.
There's an interesting origin story to the movie that I read in the, there's a Criterion Collection has a DVD Blu-ray of this. And there's a commentary that you can find online. And it says that Powell and Pressburger were talking about how they could make a quick movie during the war in black and white because there wasn't Technicolor stock available during the war in England. And so they decided that Pressburger says, well, how about something about a girl who can't reach an island, and by the time she can, she no longer wants to go? And Powell says, well, why can't she go? And Pressburger says, let's make the movie and find out.
And that's a great hook for a movie.
Yeah, it is. And they spend so much time. I mean, you believe it because of the way they do the journey. Like, she's on the train, and then there's this whole, you know, the assistant to the rich man has given her the itinerary, which includes switching from the train to overland transportation to another train, rather, to a boat. And eventually she's going to get to the, in fact, I sort of lost track until she got to the landing and couldn't get to the boat to go to Killaren right away. I lost track of a couple steps, and I was like, I hope it's not important that I remember how she got from this place to that place, because it seemed a little muddled. She seemed fine with it. She's just like, okay, one more step. At 2 o'clock, I have to be here at this time. She actually seems very unruffled until when she's actually denied the ability to go across in the gale. She seems pretty adjusted to it, the fact that she's going to have to, you know, they go from various places. They go from this sort of way station to a hotel the next day to meeting the local people. There's so many scenes of her moving from place to place within the Isle of Mull, which is the way you get to Killaren, which is fictional. The Isle of Mull, I believe, is real and Killaren is fictional. But there's so many steps and so many things that theoretically you might have to keep track of as far as her progress. But really, you don't, because it's basically about the people. It's about all these characters that she's meeting along the way, guided by her first uniform-wearing and then kilt-wearing soon-to-be boyfriend.
Can we talk about Katrina?
Yes, please.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to bring that up. Yes, please. Because my headcanon is that she loved Torquil at some point. Maybe they had a thing. Probably not. It's probably just an unrequited thing. And see, that's the woman he's probably supposed to be with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. She is a firecracker that shoots her own rabbits for dinner, is the hottest, most smoldering individual in the entire film. You know, she's got chemistry with everybody. She makes some eyes at Wendy Hiller that make you go, yeah, Katrina steals the entire movie, and that's a problem, because when she's on screen, you forget that literally anyone else in the movie exists.
Maybe the dogs give her closer. I mean, that's even fun, like to watch her with these big dog, woolly dogs.
Well, you know, she actually did. Someone did fall for her. It was the filmmaker Michael Powell.
Good move, Michael Powell.
He fell for the actress. His name was Pamela Brown, and I think they got married.
Wikipedia said they were partners, and said apparently somewhat later than the movie. I don't think they got together, or the Wikipedia doesn't know that they got together at this time. But later on, they were partners for like 15 years.
And well, we should talk about. I'm the one in this podcast that always looks to see who's still alive.
Don't jinx it.
I know where you're going. You're going downtown, aren't you?
I was going to say, don't sleep on the subway, darling. Petula Clark, of all people. I did not have this on my bingo card for this movie.
No, me neither.
Is the little girl, the little precocious girl with glasses, at the when they go to dinner at the Robinsons?
She was great. She was the second best character in the movie after Katrina.
Yes.
Also, the part was written so well, because she is not only a precocious child, but she's a precocious child who is indulged in a humorous, in a funny way by her parents, by her mother. It's so great.
And she's indulged by they let her read books constantly. And, like, her parents are horrible snobs, and she's just totally cool.
And they're like, are you going to the thing with us? And she goes, I don't know, maybe. And they're like, okay, you let us know. It's great.
Well, it looks like I'm looking at her her oeuvre, and she was in quite a few movies as a child actress, apparently. Who knew?
I did not know that. And I guess the other actors that we might have heard of are John Lurie as young Campbell.
I really liked that old couple. They were so sweet. Yeah. You almost never get to see people that old in any kind of movies, much less people that old who are portrayed as being happy and leading, you know, good, contented lives together. Mm-hmm. I just, man.
Well, there was also the nice touch of, so they give him this party, and they basically ask him to speak. And he's choked up, and he can't, and he leaves the room. But you think, oh, well, that's the last we're going to see of him. He's probably sick or something. But he comes back, and he is, you know, just happy and sociable as ever. He's just overcome by all this kindness that his friends and family did for him. And that's just an unnecessary but lovely touch.
It really is.
We haven't talked about the true star of the movie, and this is one of his only appearances. I see two appearances by him in IMDb. I'm talking, of course, about the eagle whose name is Mr. Ramshaw.
Great name for an eagle.
Mr. Ramshaw, of course, is an absolute delight.
But I mean, when the animals in this movie are making more of an impression than the leads, I feel like you should have gone back for another pass at the script there, guys.
We have dogs, we have sheep, we have the eagle and the eagle's handler, the eccentric Colonel Barnstable. And the scene in which we meet Barnstable and also Turquoil for the first time is really interesting to me because the Joan character is on this isle trying to get to the island, and she comes into this place where Katrine and all these people are that she's meeting, and they're like, oh, hi, how are you? But they're talking to each other. They do not stop to interrogate the newcomer or appreciate her or, oh, look, the city lady is here or whatever. They just go on and talking about what they're talking about. Barnstable is talking about his eagle. Katrina is talking about skinning rabbits. And Joan is very much sort of in but not of the scene. And there's several cases like that, which I think they're Powell and Pressburger are really trying to accentuate those quote-unquote minor characters who essentially become part of the sets and the props of the movie in the best way, because there's so many little touches and things that they give those characters to do that don't actually involve Joan, Wendy Hiller's character, directly. And there's a way that could really not work. But for me, in this movie, I think it did.
Well, and for me, it was, you know, you have this, so you think about her London life and her going to the nightclub, and, you know, she's able to get in when it's very full and that sort of thing. And then her train trip up to get up there, and it's sort of like this, you know, this glitz and glamour, and she gets a suite because she's marrying the wealthy industrialist. And then she gets there, and the, you know, the house is kind of beat up, and you've got all of these characters moving around, and this is probably not the kind of atmosphere that she's ever experienced before. And I think it would have been kind of fun to get maybe a scene of her watching all of the circus go on around her and sort of, you know, enjoying it and sort of like, you know, maybe not focusing on making the boat, maybe saying, well, you know, this is kind of fun and maybe I'll stay an extra day and just, you know, I am getting married, but it might be kind of fun to just see what these Scots are up to. And I would have loved to have seen that little scene that would have knit some of this together. I mean, I think Caloran is pretty attractive myself, and yes, he's got acreage, but I mean, I could see falling for him, and especially because, you know, he is probably supposed to hook up with Katrina at some point, and it doesn't happen, and so that's I think very interesting. He probably looks upon her as a sister more than someone to marry, but then, you know, here comes Joan. And possibly for the first time he's ever thinking about a woman that he would end up with.
A sister who he kisses on the mouth, if I'm remembering
well,
correctly.
Yeah.
Although that could just be Katrina.
Well, it could be like, you know, Angelina Jolie and her brother.
I think it's interesting because the movie, I think, gives us the scenes that you're talking about where we're we're seeing, I mean, we're supposed to fall in love with the people and the landscape mm-hmm. and the life there. But yeah, you're right. Joan herself doesn't have that revelation moment. Even at the party, when she's sort of watching and looking on, most of the time she's kind of thinking about, how can I talk this guy into taking me out on the boat? And she kind of, you know, because she stays on the sidelines, she really doesn't get involved in it. And so she's seeing it without really experiencing it. And yeah, I think it would have been interesting to have her sort of make that transformative moment. And I think that also might help with my problem with the ultimate chemistry between them. I'm not talking about like the literal chemistry, but more so, hi, I've made a decision that I can be comfortable living in this environment. And the only way we get that is at the very end when she says, okay, I don't need a swimming pool and we can fish for salmon, which is very little in a movie that's an hour and a half long.
Yeah, she exists in a weird vacuum. All the other supporting characters interact with her, but really very little with one another. Even with the party scene, there's very little sense of the life of the village around them. It's all just, you know, how characters relate to her. And I can understand her not wanting to stay, because the whole point of the movie is that she is a single-minded arrow flying toward that island and constantly, you know, thwacking into things along the way. Like Daffy Duck in Robin Hood Daffy, constantly swinging from one tree only to smack into the next one over and over again. But it doesn't fully work. This is such a well-made movie. The cinematography is gorgeous. Some of those twilight and dusk shots are extraordinary. So it's really odd for me, among all these charming supporting characters and great lines, to have this kind of hollowness at the core of it.
You know, what's really interesting is that Torquil, Roger Livesey, is never actually on location. He was doing a play, and I think in London, and so he's never there. Anybody you think is him on location in Scotland is actually a body double.
Get in the stunt kilt.
Yeah, I couldn't help but wonder, and I have a couple Scottish friends, and I probably should maybe quiz them on this. I'd have to make them watch the movie first, but we'll see how that goes. But I couldn't help but wondering how much of the sort of small town Scottish ways and then place names and the who wears a kilt and who doesn't and when and all that. I wonder to an English audience how familiar that stuff seems. Like, is this part of Scotland really the far provinces, or is it a part of England that they may not be of, but that they sort of understand? I was kind of curious about that, especially since there's Gaelic in the movie. There's a lot of talk about, you know, a particular kind of small town life. And, you know, we've got sheep that are being molested by eagles or foxes and what people are going to do about it. And you're riding buses from one little town to another. I am a Scotch drinker, and so I know some of those place names because they've had whiskeys named after them, including, I might add, Corey Vrecken, which is a very good Scotch from Ardbeg.
Well, I think so the parts of Scotland that the English would be familiar with would be Edinburgh and Glasgow. And
so the
possibly,
big cities only.
Yeah, no, but the coast.
Maybe Aberdeen.
Around Aberdeen, St. Andrews, Fife, you know, so sort of the more eastern, northeastern pieces of Scotland. So where this island is to the west, and you're talking about, you know, pretty hard place to get to. I mean, today people go to these places, you know, and there's a great interest in going to the Hebrides and the Isle of Skye and places like that. But back in 1945, in right at the end of World War II, you couldn't get anywhere. I mean, the troops were on the trains. And that is something I wanted to mention about her long journey to get up there, because it was quite lucky on her part to be able to get seats on a train and a suite on a train at a time when the war was going on or was ending or whatever. So yeah, I think this was probably a little bit exotic to a conventional English audience. They would know of Scotland, but it would be the more, you know, familiar settled parts of Scotland than the islands of Scotland.
Well, I'm curious if you know geography of Scotland. So the shooting took place on the Isle of Mull. Mm-hmm. And there's a song by Paul McCartney and Wings called Mull of Kintyre, which is actually one of the best-selling singles of all time in the UK. It was like a huge, huge hit. And I was wondering, is Mull of Kintyre, is that connected to the Isle of Mull and where this was filmed?
I believe it is. And McCartney is someone who loves Scotland. I mean, they loved going up there. So I could see very much that there's an indirect connection, if nothing else.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that this song was so popular that Scottish heritage must be something that really touches British people, and I assume even back in the 40s when this film was made.
Aren't the Scots all about England? Please leave us alone.
Well, there's a traditional rivalry, absolutely. And then obviously the queen, the late queen, her mother was a Scotswoman. And the late queen felt very, very comfortable. I actually stayed at Balmoral. So I love that part of Scotland. But that's the northeast part of Scotland, not the Isles over there. Yeah. Oh, lovely. Oh, I love Ballater. Yeah. I would live there. I mean, people always say, where in the world would you live if you had the ability or the money? And I'd move there in a heartbeat. I absolutely love it. So, but the Isles are much more rugged and harder to get to than the more sophisticated cities that you can get to on the train.
Even still, there are islands that, I mean, you basically take a ferry. Yeah. It's not quite as primitive as the little motorboat, which I saw that boat as like under, in any conditions, that seems like not a great craft to take across.
No, she was, and I think that the idea was that that was the last resort to get over there.
So there were two other performers that were considered for this movie, instead of Wendy Hiller and...
Roger Livesey.
And that was James Mason and Deborah Kerr. James Mason and Deborah Kerr. And apparently James Mason thought he was going to have to live rough during the filming in Scotland. So he's like, I'm too fancy for that.
As a huge fan of James Mason, I would have loved to see that. I would have been like, yeah, I'll follow you anywhere, James. I will.
Yeah, he would have had a little more sex appeal, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
In 1945, that'd be great.
Oh yeah.
Another bit of trivia about the performers is that I think that Wendy Hiller is supposed to be 25, and Roger Livesey is supposed to be he talked about it, like 31 or so, but they're actually each about 5 or 6 years older in real life.
It shows. He's 39.
It shows. Yeah, because I thought, I was watching it, and I thought, is this one of those cases where you watch, where you see people in the past, and they look older than their age? am I just seeing that, like, looking in a yearbook from the 50s, and you're like, these people look really old for being 17? But it wasn't that. They actually were older than their characters. And actually, they almost didn't hire Roger Livesey because they thought he was too chubby and looked too old, so he lost 20 pounds.
I was going to say, he looks emaciated in this movie.
Yeah, he was on a diet to slim down. Yeah,
but yeah, it's a definite 90210 situation going on here. None of these people are remotely convincing as being as young as they are.
No, and I think if the Joan character had seemed younger, I think maybe her ambition would have read a little bit differently. I think as a person who's, she's in her early 30s and she's very clear about her ambition, but she's kind of beyond the spunky feisty. She's more like, I am making a business deal, and the only way I can do it is if I get across this island, here, take my money. Across to this island, here, take my money. And if she were a little bit younger, it would be interesting because it feels like the ambition would be sort of more, like toward the very end, like when she really can't get him to take her across before she finally convinces him, there's a moment or two where she's really desperate and she says something like, I'm about to lose my greatest chance or whatever. And that's never paid off. We don't know why it is that she thinks if she doesn't go over there today, it's not going to happen. And I would kind of like that either to be paid off or to see why she believes it, even if it wasn't true. And maybe if she were younger or playing to in a younger way, that might read a little differently.
I think she says she's about to lose her greatest chance because she knows she's falling for Torquil, and she's trying to outrun that. And that that, you know, the one time in the movie where her character is given an inner life, I thought was really compelling and interesting. And I would have liked to see more of that.
I guess I can see that in retrospect after the movie's over. But at that time in the movie, it's not clear what that meant. It felt like it meant more that if she didn't get there, there was a deadline and she was going to lose the rich boyfriend. But after finishing the movie, yeah, I thought the same thing you did. But it just feels like that's another reason for either their chemistry or something else in the plot to give us a little bit of a hint that this is happening, because she doesn't really spend a lot of the movie. What Katrina says is, you know, she's running away from you, and she's right, but that's not really shown either to Torquil or to us before then.
You are absolutely correct.
And I think another part of it is, you know, we're given this extensive itinerary and all these people meeting her different places and escorting her onto trains and that sort of thing. And, you know, the itinerary is basically blown. And I think she's concerned that, you know, he might have other things to do. He's a wealthy industrialist, you know, maybe he's got to go see a factory or something. And it could reflect their relationship that, you know, even though she knew what she wanted, which was supposedly the wealthy industrialist, he has a say in this as well. And he set up all of the schedule for her to get to him on his island. And if she just literally misses the boat, that he might, you know, he might move on. He might not be as sure a thing as she thinks he is.
But can he get off of the island where he is?
I don't know. I mean, he might have a plane.
That's true.
I keep thinking, where are airplanes? You know, it's sort of like those movies where, like, the whole thing could be solved with a cell phone. This is one of those movies where doesn't anybody have a plane?
air travel, even at this period, was still pretty dangerous and ramshackle, especially in a smaller
plane. And during
the
war, I would imagine it would be hard to come by. Yeah, harder right. to come by.
Yeah. And with the winds, the gale's going to blow the plane around.
Well, okay, I have a wind concern, because we see the gale kick up over the ocean, not only while they're on the ocean, but when they're right next to it. You hear the wind, you see the waves. But when they're moving around on land by bus, when they're going into buildings and then coming out of them, there doesn't seem to be anything going on in the sky. There are no shutters flapping. There are no breezes breezing. It's just all perfectly calm and fine. And everybody walks around in a gale. And the hurricanes and gales and that sort of thing, they don't just stay on the ocean. They tend to hit land as well.
Oh, it's a war movie. Who has the money for a wind machine?
It's situational gales.
I'm writing that title down right now.
I had a real problem with the storm sequence, too. I didn't really feel like it was thrilling. I mean, it's interesting. You never see like an action sequence set around a giant whirlpool, and I like that. But it drags on forever. You don't really, I mean, you understand the stakes. They have to fix this or they will all die. But you don't understand the steps that they need to take to fix the engine, which robs it of a lot of suspense. They're just doing stuff. It didn't work for me. It was just like, okay, can we get on with this? Can we get past this? Can they either drown or get back to shore, one or the other? I'll take either one at this point.
I had a little of that feeling too. Like I felt like they're going to go through all this, especially since they came back, I felt like something needed to have happened. Like she needed to be shown to have changed, or he needed to knock some sense into her, not literally, or something needed, or God forbid, the guy driving the boat, Kenny, needs to have gone overboard so that she feels terrible. I mean, something needs to happen, and nothing really does. They have a problem.
Like that.
I know. I agree. I feel terrible for saying it, but just as a plot point, I was like that when that started, when they're all three on the boat, I'm like, something has to happen in this scene. Either they have to get there and she has to be disappointed, or they have to not get there and something needs to have happened between the characters, hopefully not involving death or drowning, that changes the course of the plot or the course of her feeling about things.
And it doesn't. It's just like, hey, you, a determined woman, you're stupid. Shame on you for being determined and wanting things. There's also that weird kind of misogynistic curse in the ancient ruined keep what's his title again?
McLaren. He's the Laird of McLaren.
McNeil of Caloran.
Yeah, no layer of chlorine can enter, and it's like the terrible curses. You will fall in love with a woman. Oh no!
Right. You well, they withhold that for a long time, and I like the point where he says, "Yeah, when I was a kid, I didn't go into the castle, but I had a nanny that went in and read the curse." And you know, the literal words of the curse are something like, "You will be chained to a woman forever." And I suppose in the reading for somebody who is not in love and who hasn't just finished a romance movie, oh, that sounds terrible. That sounds like just what happened to the people who died in the curse. But yeah, it's
well, it's a little bit back to Philadelphia Story. I mean, at the very end, when Tracy realizes that she loves C.K. Dexter Haven, and you know that's the man for her, and he realizes that she is just as much that she is the woman for him, and he'd given up on her. And so here's the Laird of Caloran who goes, you know, braves himself to go into the castle keep and read this, the curse, and realizes, wait a minute, this is the woman for me. And gee, lo and behold, here she comes, you know, with some, with a band to
with
lead him.
The trio of bagpipers.
The trio of bagpipers.
Romantic strains of bagpipes.
Yeah, yeah, to lead him away and off to happiness, apparently.
Really setting that mood there.
Not everybody has bagpipers around for the wedding. Did she have to pay them since she didn't end up marrying the guy? I mean, I guess they're going to go back. They're going to go back to the island, but why? Because they were hired to go for the wedding. Oh, anyway, I should not worry about
things
like that.
They're
just
going to kick out a medley of funky jams. All the good breakup songs.
Jams.
Bagpipers playing Taylor Swift's We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together.
That's how she breaks the news to him. It's either that or over the radio in that, you know, well, what she meant to say was, anyways.
So I have some, there's a connection to the actress Amy Adams. From
Gosh, isn't she Irish, I think?
She might be. So there, this movie inspired a 2010 film called Leap Years.
It's
starring
a really
Amy
bad
Adams.
Movie.
Oh, it's so bad.
Yes.
It's
so bad.
It's like
yes.
the crayon template of a romantic comedy.
And it takes place in Ireland instead of Scotland. But I have to read Nathan Rabin, however you pronounce his last name, of the AV Club. He's a great critic, and he said that, quote, "This film functions as the cinematic equivalent of a shamrock shake. sickeningly artificially sweet, formulaic, and about as authentically Gaelic as an Irish Spring commercial."
Well, fortunately, I don't think you can accuse our movie of those sins, fortunately.
Absolutely not.
I would encourage you, if you like such things and if you have some to hand, get yourself a dram of Corey Vrekin and have some of that while you watch this movie. At least if I had some, that's what I would have done, because I was thinking to myself, how long has it been since I've had any Corey Vrekin with Whirlpools? And see, other whiskey brands, Oban, Tobermory. Sorry, I watch for important things like whiskey references, or not references, but Scottish towns that have been turned in.
Well, and there's a Tobermory in Canada, in Ontario as well. So I was thinking about that when I was watching this, the great Canadian connection.
And we should emphasize that this movie is not so bad that it will drive you to need a glass of whiskey, just that a glass of whiskey might enhance it.
No, I will say that the scene where the guy is shooting the whiskey, I was like, don't do that to scotch. Not only because it's expensive and it's good stuff and you're wasting it, but that's hardcore. If you can actually take scotch, which is often higher than the usual 80 proof, and if you can shoot it, that is hardcore, and I'm worried about you.
I was wondering if the closed captionist might have had a little whiskey on board, because I turned on the closed captioning, and every once in a while when somebody Scottish would speak with a heavy accent, but they were speaking English, not Gaelic, it would just say inaudible.
Oh. That sounds like AI doing it. I'm just blaming everything on AI now, and I think I'm going to be proven right in many cases.
Yes.
Well, friends, thank you so much for discussing I Know Where I'm Going, which allegedly I do. a Palin Pressburger movie from 1945. It is available in many From many sources, you can get the Criterion disc if you're fancy and want to hear the commentary, or you can find it free from a number of places. I actually watched it on Plex. You could get it from Canopy. So I will have links to all the many places you can either stream or get disc copies of this. If you want to follow us on Lions, Towers, and Shield, please go to theincomparable.com/LTS. You can email us at lts@theincomparable.com. or on the socials, we're Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. Thanks to my panelists for being here, and we'll be back with another film next week. Bye now.
The Incomparable Podcast Network. Become a member and support this show today. TheIncomparable.com/members.